Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, marking 47 years of commitment to operating the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com.
Alaska's Rail Belt residents from Fairbanks to the Kenai Peninsula have relied on power generation and cooperation from four utilities for their business and household power for decades. And for decades, natural gas has been the main source of fuel for energy generation. But declining gas reserves in Cook Inlet mean imported gas may be in our not-too-distant future. So what might that mean for your electric bill in the next decade? What's the best plan to provide cost-effective and reliable energy for our economic future? Alaska energy experts join us to discuss building an integrated rail belt plan today on Talk of Alaska.
I'm Theo Greenlee, a reporter with the Alaska Desk. That's a joint reporting effort from Alaska Public Media and KUCB, where I work in Unalaska, and other public radio stations in Anchorage, Fairbanks, Haines, and the Aleutians. It allows us to connect you with the issues happening in communities all across the state. You can hear our stories during the morning news, Alaska News Nightly, or online at alaskapublic.org. The Alaska Desk is only possible with the support of grants and listeners like you. Thank you.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, from Alaska Public Media, it's Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. For most of us, paying the monthly electric bill or swapping out light bulbs is the extent of our involvement with a convenient system connected right to our homes that makes life much easier, especially in the dark of winter. Reliability, knowing that light or heat system will come on when we need it, is not often front of mind. You flip on a switch and walk away, because most of the time our electrical grid is very reliable. But legislation that created the Rail Belt Reliability Council, the RRC, tasked that body with developing an integrated resource plan, an IRP, that seeks to bring power producers, businesses, and consumers together to build a system that creates efficiencies, reliability, and affordability far into the future. If this sounds wonky and technical, it is, but it's also important for how our households and our future economy will either thrive with affordable energy or atrophy if costs soar. Alaskans like to be involved, and there are roles for everyone in this plan. And today, we'll discuss what the aim is for the future and how you can weigh in. Okay, because this is a big plan and we want Alaskans to understand how to be involved, my editor suggested we ban the acronyms I just used. So let's try to avoid RRC and IRP and any others that you all hear my guests use every day, but sound like a foreign language to those of us not immersed in this world. That will help everyone stay in the conversation. In the studio with me today is Ed Jenkins. Ed is the president and CEO of the Rail Belt Reliability Council, the organization tasked with putting the integrated resource plan together. Also in the studio is Katie Lister. Katie is the executive director of REAP, which stands for Renewable Energy Alaska Project. And Katie is on the Reliability Council board. Travis Million is on the line from Fairbanks, where he is the president and CEO of GVEA, Golden Valley Electric Association, and also a board member of the new Rail Belt Reliability Council. Welcome, all of you.
Morning.
Thanks for being here. So, Ed, let's start with you with an overview of why there is a Rail Belt Reliability Council. Talk about what prompted its formation.
There were two things, primarily. One from what we heard from legislators was just a concern of a lack of coordination amongst the Rail Belt utilities, those utilities from Homer to Fairbanks, in planning their future, and the recognition that if we planned everything together, we could probably do it more efficiently and do a better job of maintaining rates as low as possible. The other side of the coin was the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. Those individuals that are over the RRC, Rail Belt Reliability Council, and over the utilities. So they had specific concerns that there weren't any standards that were reliability standards that all utilities had to comply with equally, and that there was no enforcement of those. Utilities were still doing a good job of keeping the lights on, obviously. But with cybersecurity, there was increased concern. So those two factors led to the start of the RSC and the legislation that created the organization to develop standards and develop an integrated resource plan.
Wow. Thank you for breaking down what is obviously huge into bite-sized pieces, and we'll drill down more on some of that legislation and other things going forward. Thank you. Travis, you've been in the electric industry in Alaska for nearly 20 years, a little more than two at the helm of GVEA. You said there's been a lot of unsuccessful attempts to find collaboration among the utilities. Why is that? It would seem there is a need to be cooperative or share resources. Why is it difficult to do this?
You know, it's really hard to say. There's been just over the years, so many attempts of trying to unify the rail belt and bring all the utilities together. And you know, from my perspective, and like you said, I've been with Golden Valley for just over 2 years now, but I was with Copper Valley Electric for quite a while, kind of watching the rail belt from the sidelines. And, you know, it would always be, you know, one utility or another. Everybody took turns on why or why not something would or would not work. And it's just been a struggle, I would say, for as long as I've been in Alaska to really truly unify the rail belt. And for one reason or another, there's always been hiccups along the line that has just caused this separation to where things just truly don't pull together like would be beneficial for the entire rail belt.
Okay, so lawmakers said, all right, we're going to put legislation together to sort of force this to happen. So, Travis, start us off, and then Ed and Katie, please jump in. What does the council require of the utilities to do? How does this change that equation to make this cooperation happen?
Yeah, from my standpoint, when SB 123 was passed, which started the Rail Belt Reliability Council, really, it, like Ed had talked about, it helps to develop these standards. All the utilities have to partake in the Reliability Council, plus outside entities as well. So it was a mix of utilities and other stakeholders from outside the utility industry that they had to participate and help stand up these standards. And then obviously the utilities, once these standards are developed and approved, the utilities would be required to meet these standards. And that's really where Ed and his group and the board and the technical working groups are really building that up for integration for us utilities to then move forward to integrate these standards.
Ed, want to add something there, or did he cover it well?
You're going to have to go back to the beginning of the question.
Oh, sorry. Lawmakers put together legislation saying, hey, we need cooperation. If we have to force it, we will. Here's some legislation. So what does the council then require of utilities?
First of all, participation. You know, we do two things. We do standards. We do an integrated resource plan. So the organization was developed with all the utilities on the board. They all have a seat. The board's balanced between utilities and non-utilities, between energy producers and energy users on purpose. But still, the utilities are the ones that have to comply with standards. And really, they're the ones that have to implement the integrated resource plan. So their participation along the path is critical, and they do participate because they obviously understand the impact on them. They understand their loads, they understand their members. So there's a lot of coordination with the utilities and a lot of input they provide. And then once we have a standard integrated resource plan, there's the implementation of those things. And where standards are, there's a requirement and there's penalties if you don't comply. So they stay abreast of all those things and are pretty involved because of the impact it has on them primarily.
If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska, and we're talking about the future of rail belt energy, the 700-mile corridor from Fairbanks to the Kenai Peninsula, and about 75% of the state's population lives along that corridor and is affected by these decisions that will drive energy policy in the future. In the studio with me today is Ed Jenkins. Ed is the president and CEO of the Rail Belt Reliability Council. Katie Lister is also in the studio. Katie is the executive director of REAP, Renewable Energy Alaska Project. And on the line from Fairbanks, Travis Million is with us. Travis is the president and CEO of GVEA, Golden Valley Electric Association. Katie, REAP's focus is right in the name, renewable energy. Talk about what that work looks like across the state and what you see as REAP's role on the Rail Belt Reliability Board.
Sure. Maybe if I can just first take a little step back and add something to the question.
Absolutely.
Before. I think that it is one thing I just wanted to make clear, I think, for folks listening at home, because I think Alaskans are used to or are sometimes tired of planning, right? Like, we do a lot of planning in the state, and often it feels like we don't do a lot of implementing. So we're here talking about another plan, and that can feel a little bit unexciting. The reason that this IRP, or Integrated Resource Plan, is really a big deal is that the legislature did take action. They passed state law that mandates that the utilities must work together for any planning for future investments on this electric system, which serves about 75% of the population of the state. So that's a big deal that has a huge impact on our homes, our businesses, and really the economy of the entire state. In the past, I mean, utilities have been doing a good job providing power to their service areas, and they have been doing internal planning, but they have been failing to plan in a regional way and really losing out on efficiencies because of that. So we haven't had the most efficient and effective system to serve the entire state. So really just wanting to kind of elevate the importance of this integrated resource plan, you know, being led by the Rail Belt Reliability Council under Ed's leadership, I think is it's a more important and plan that will have a little bit more teeth and more incentives associated with it, so that it will actually guide implementation and guide investment in this system that we all rely on along the Rail Belt system in the coming years. So just that to the prior question.
Thank you.
In terms of REAP's role on the board, I mean, REAP holds a seat on the Rail Belt Reliability Council. We hold seat L, and that is on the board of directors. Anthony Scott is actually the primary. He's a REAP staff person who's our head of economic and regulatory affairs, a former commissioner for the Regulatory Commission of Alaska and an economist. And I'm the alternate. And the two of us also participate in different working groups in the development of the Integrated Resource Plan. REAP is there as sort of an advocate for renewable energy and energy efficiency, just ensuring that those resources are considered and considered well in the development of the plan. In terms of what REAP does statewide, we are a nonprofit organization whose purpose is to advance renewable energy and energy efficiency statewide. We have K-12 education programs. We work in the workforce development space. We do rural utility operator training. So we have a number of different sort of programs that serve different constituencies in different parts of the state. But a lot of the work that we do is really policy focused, and on the Rail Belt, it is particularly right now, especially just because of the timeliness of these initiatives, is really active. A lot of time and energy going into the work of the Rail Belt Reliability Council. REAP was instrumental in getting the legislation passed that set up the RRC and worked on standing up the organization. And my predecessor was sort of on the hiring committee that brought Ed on board and, you know, has been really wanting to ensure that the policy that the organization helped to advance is implemented in a way that is consistent with its intent.
And what's your vision for increasing renewable energy for the Rail Belt? Right now, it's primarily gas, with some hydro from Bradley Lake. Wind power from Fire Island provides some energy that offsets gas. What would you like to see in the next decade for bringing on more hydro, solar, wind, tidal? What's the goal for REAP?
Our goal is always more renewable energy because it is stable priced, clean and local, and more energy efficiency because it means that we're only using the energy that we need. I think that our vision for the rail belt is a system that is optimized at on a regional basis so that there is adequate assets, both transmission assets, storage assets, power generation assets, and demand side management sort of technology and programs so that the people of Alaska are both receiving power that is affordable, that they know what the price is going to be today, but they also kind of have a sense of what the price might be 5 years from now, which is a significant question as we look at importing gas, which is such a large share of the sort of power generation portfolio right now. I mean, I think anytime you have a high dependency on one thing and that one thing is about to sort of change in terms of its cost structure, that puts us in a pretty vulnerable position. You know, I often like to sort of remind people that Bradley Lake, which is the state-owned hydro resource that's on the rail belt, that was built during the 1980s when the state had a lot of oil revenue coming in. At the time that it was built, it was the most expensive power on the rail belt, and it is now the cheapest power on the rail belt. And that's because the cost of that power hasn't changed, because the cost of the water that is in that system isn't impacted by geopolitical events and isn't tied to any global markets in the way that imported gas will be and in the way that oil and diesel is and always will be.
From Allie in Palmer, Allie writes, I'm writing to submit this question for consideration. We've had rail belt-wide studies and planning efforts, as you've noted here, in the past that didn't always translate into consistent utility decisions. What makes the integrated resource plan different, especially given that the Rail Belt Reliability Council doesn't have enforcement authority? How do you see the IRP, the Integrated Resource Plan, meaningfully guiding decisions across utilities? Ed, you want to take that?
Sure, thank you. So when legislation formed the Rail Belt Reliability Council and gave us the task of developing the Integrated Resource Plan, it also changed the law such that it indicated that those projects that come out of the Integrated Resource Plan are presumed to be the appropriate projects for the rail belt. So what it did is it gave the Regulatory Commission of Alaska the authority over the utilities, over the council. The requirement to approve projects before they're built.
So there are some teeth here.
So yes. So now the commission, when they have projects come before them for pre-approval, there's a presumption that if it came out of the Integrated Resource Plan, that it's good for the rail belt. Doesn't mean others can't submit projects, but they have a higher hurdle to go through, more hearings, significantly larger costs to go through to get approved if they come from some other location other than the Integrated Resource Plan. So no, the Integrated Resource Plan can't require something to be built, but if something is to be built, is needed, it gives the presumption that those projects out of the Integrated Resource Plan are the right projects for the rail belt.
So not good for just one utility, but for all the system, for the entire system.
Yeah, and as Travis noted earlier, you know, that was one of the impediments before. When you tried to do integrated resource planning, maybe the benefits of those projects weren't equal amongst all the utilities. So there's always an argument about cost sharing and who pays for what. Mm-hmm. Well, now the goal is what's best for everybody, and everybody pays for it.
All right. And as we're trying to do today, the discussion is aimed at clarifying what the Rail Belt Reliability Council and the Integrated Resource Plan are, as well as helping Alaskans know that their input is needed and in this process. But beyond caring about how much their electric bill will be in 5 years, what do you expect to hear from the average consumer that would be helpful in building this plan? What are you looking for or seeking for comment?
So right now, we have a working group that has just started out. And what they are doing is they are discussing what are the objectives of the Integrated Resource Plan? What do we need to measure? And what do we need to look towards to help decisions be made as far as the future resources on the railroad, whether those resources are transmission lines, generation, whether it's the efficiency projects or energy storage, whatever those resources are. So it's a discussion amongst the stakeholders. The stakeholders include the utilities, include REAP, include independent power producers, includes consumer seats. But there's always room for those individuals that have some insight that they want to leave with the committee that's developing these goals, these objectives for the plan. So those meetings are all open for the public. And members of the public have the ability to speak either at the start or the end of the meeting and provide their input into, you know, what is important for them. Yes, we have stakeholders that represent those individuals, but individuals are always free to come and express their own opinion.
Anything you'd want to add, Katie?
Yeah, I think just, and I don't know if we maybe started off with this, but just to note, just to kind of say out front for folks who don't know, I mean, an integrated resource plan, it will choose a sort of a mix of power generation resources like wind, hydro, solar, gas, demand-side management, storage, and transmission assets with a goal of providing safe, reliable, and affordable energy while managing risks. I think that the question was kind of in addition to affordability, what are some considerations? The IRP process or the Integrated Resource Plan, it's very hard not to use
Thank
acronyms.
You.
The Integrated Resource Plan process requires that there be at least two different portfolios or plans that are presented to the council. So there will be two plans to consider, and then the working group with all the stakeholders that Ed mentioned will evaluate those and choose the one that is the highest value. And highest value is somewhat subjective, and it should take into consideration things like environmental impact, risk of fuel price volatility, things like that, price stability, reliability, safety, and affordability, of course. And so how relatively important each of those potential variables are is not prescriptive. It's not in the legislation. There's not like an algorithm
it's not weighted.
And so some of, I think, why it feels very really important for people who rely on this system and are paying those bills and live in the communities where the power is generated and the transmission lines go through, why it feels important for all of those folks to have the opportunity to understand what the plan is and to provide public input is because that can be integrated into the working groups conversations about what highest value means. What is the highest value to the public? And so that's one of the primary thing objectives that REAP has both in working with the RRC or the Railroad Reliability Council on the Integrated Resource Plan is not just as an advocate for renewable energy and energy efficiency, but also as an advocate for members of the public who might not have felt like this conversation was very accessible. So giving them sort of the pathways, and the Railroad Reliability Council does a great job of, you know, creating space for that to be able to tell us what you think is valuable. Is environmental impact really important? Is affordability really important? You know, just letting the sort of decision makers know what you think.
Travis, would you like to add to that as well?
You know, I think Katie and Ed did a great job hitting that standpoint. And I think, you know, it's just imperative that it's good how it's structured to where there are the different stakeholders, utilities, and others outside the utility space that are involved with this process and providing input throughout. Because, you know, I think depending on where you're at throughout the state along the rail belt, you're going to have differing opinions on, you know, what's the highest priority. You're going to have different priorities in Fairbanks than you are in Anchorage or in Homer. And so I really think that the process and how the board is structured and the process that the Rail Belt Reliability Council has been going through to develop this integrated resource plan and get it just started off and going is imperative for the entire rail belt.
All right. And Ed, you wanted to add something?
Yeah. There was a question about, there's been lots of plans. Well, one of the issues with a lot of those plans is they were done by specific organizations that were looking at a very narrow perspective about what they thought would be best and how the rail belt should develop based upon that organization's view. And that's what another reason why this plan is so significant is it's done through a stakeholder organization with representatives from many voices to bring together a plan that in the end identifies all the things that this group thinks it needs to produce as far as what type of data that comes out of it, what type of environmental data, what type of economic data, among other things, so that we can come to a decision as a group, as a community, to come forth with a plan that meets the needs of not just one voice, but the multiple voices that are represented on the RRC board and members of the public.
All right. That sounds fantastic. We are going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion about the future of rail belt energy as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
I'm Shelby Herbert, a reporter with the Alaska Desk. That's a joint reporting effort from Alaska Public Media and KUAC, where I work in Fairbanks, and other public radio stations in Anchorage, Haines, and the Aleutians. It allows us to connect you with the issues happening in communities all across the state. You can hear our stories during the morning news, Alaska News Nightly, or online at alaskapublic.org. The Alaska Desk is only possible with the support of grants and listeners like you. Thank you.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're discussing the future of rail belt energy today. In the studio with me are Ed Jenkins, who is the president and CEO of the Rail Belt Reliability Council. Katie Lister is also with us. She is the executive director of REAP, Renewable Energy Alaska Project. And on the line from Fairbanks is Travis Million. Travis is the president and CEO of GVEA, Golden Valley Electric Association. And you know, when I say you can call in statewide, there might be folks in far reaches of the state thinking, well, why do we care what rail belt energy costs? But it is important for the entire state, correct? Because what we pay here on the rail belt has influence on the power cost equalization formula, does it not?
It does.
That's what I thought. So this is important for the entire state.
Right. So as prices go down here, it has an effect upon the price you pay for the whole state.
All right.
As far as your power cost of equalization.
Okay.
Importantly, too, I would just add that, you know, Anchorage and Fairbanks are the commercial and business and service centers for the state. So as the prices of things go up here, if the cost of doing business in Anchorage and Fairbanks goes up, that translates to additional cost to providing services and goods and services in rural communities as well.
That's such an important point to remember, that it's not just the direct cost of turning the lights on or your heat system. It is the cost of doing business. So if you're selling a certain type of good and your electric bill goes up by 30%, you're going to have to adjust the cost of the goods you're selling to the public. So thank you for that reminder. Let's go to the phones for a moment. Ed is in Anchorage. Hello, Ed.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I had a question about, the Sioux Sitna Dam project's been around for years. And you look at the economics of that, that's a 1,200 megawatt power plant that would power the whole rail belt, plus additional load could be added. There's already 115 kVA transmission line right past it. It would stabilize the spawning beds in the lower Sioux Sitna, and from an environmental perspective, it has benefits. It just seems like that's a win-win. It's about a $4 billion project, $5 billion. And you look at what we've spent already on gas power plants. If we'd have pooled that money earlier, we could have already bought that power plant, and we'd have free energy. Like you guys said earlier about Bradley Lake, it's the lowest cost power in the whole rail belt. And Sioux City, the dam would be too. So that's my comment.
All right. Thanks for the question, Ed. He did mention free power, but I don't think we'll ever get to the point where there's free power unless, of course, you somehow are gifted a whole bunch of solar panels and put them on your house. Then maybe you get some free power. But there's always going to be a cost to energy. What about Susitna Dam?
You know, Susitna Dam, as was noted, has been around a long time. It has a lot of study work. I think they're still working through some of the permitting associated with that. The state has funded that on and off for years to try to move that project along. Certainly, it's a project. I mean, it's a project that produces a lot of energy. But again, one of the things we look at is just not generation, but what does it take to move that generation? I mean, 1,200 megawatts. Yes, there's an existing 115,000-volt line that runs right by there that moves about 80 megawatts reliably. So you have to build a whole lot more transmission to incorporate a very large project like Wetana into the system. So there's other impacts you have to consider when evaluating a project. Just the generation project is in itself. You know, Katie noted, what's the impacts? There are impacts to that project that are environmental. You have to consider those things. So there's a lot of things that go into consideration. What's nice about this plan is it's going to bring those projects together, put them all on the equal playing field with input from a wide stakeholder group to put forth what they think is the best project, what economics say is the best project, but really what the greatest value for the rail belt as seen when you consider a lot of other things on the rail belt.
Mm-hmm. Katie?
I mean, I think that Ed described it pretty clearly. You know, there's always technical, economic, environmental, and political considerations, and those are things that will be part of the equation in the integrated resource plan when looking at any resource anywhere on the rail belt. And just for clarification, because Ed called it Wetana and the caller called it Susitna, the project has in various iterations been called Susitna, Susitna, Wetana, or Wetana. Yeah.
All right. Thank you for that clarification. We have a question from Martin by email. Martin writes, at one time, the idea of generating power on the North Slope with the gas readily available there and transmitting the power via high voltage lines to population center south. This has always seemed to me the most practical and economic way to go, providing electricity cheap enough to use even for heating. Also, Fairbanks wouldn't have to worry about being left out as with a gas line. Anchorage wouldn't fret about Cook Inlet. Is it still being considered? If not, why not? And Travis, what are your thoughts about that question?
Yeah, it's kind of funny because years ago, this is probably 15, 18, 20 years ago, this I know was getting quite a bit of traction throughout the state to generate electricity using natural gas on the slope where the natural gas was. They were looking at the time at using high voltage DC transmission lines to move energy from the North Slope down into the rail belt grid. The company I was working for at the time was heavily involved with that analysis. And I know that as it was being evaluated, it kind of grew to where, well, instead of just getting power to the rail belt, let's look at trying to expand out to Western Alaska as well and try to, you know, benefit those communities out there that are not interconnected. And I think the scope kind of grew quite a bit. But I think overall at the time, the technology for high voltage DC transmission was not, it was fairly recent, fairly new, wasn't utilized in abundance as much as it is used today, to where it really wasn't penciling out at the time. I don't know of any work that's really been done recently to reevaluate that work. But I mean, it's been talked about for quite a while, and there could be some great benefits, especially if you can get the transmission cost down to where it would be economical to move that power south. Because I mean, if you're not having to move the fuel and you're generating right where the fuel source is, that could be a huge cost savings. But like I said, I'm not sure of what additional work has been done, you know, in the last 5 or 10 years, but I know it was looked at, you know, a couple decades ago for sure.
Does seem like a long way to run power lines, but I'm not a utility expert. What do I know? Let's go back to the phones. Bill is in Juneau. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Katie. Thank you for taking over for Chris. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
We've been supporting the REAP for decades from the Leedy Foundation and personally from our pockets, so keep up the good work. Isn't the objective for the rail belt to be totally greenhouse gas emission free? And that will require looking at the cost of energy beyond whatever we pay for the electricity bill to including some sort of compensation for the external costs, greenhouse gas emissions from burning any kind of fossil fuels for it. Second question, won't this require simplifying the rail belt utility, something that Chris was working on for many decades? How is that going? And third, rather than trying to do something other than bring ANS gas south to Fairbanks by the truckload, what about deep, hot, dry rock geothermal right beneath our feet, right at the military bases and elsewhere to feed the grid? That's enough for now. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill, for the call.
Well, those are three pretty big topics, so I might just touch lightly on some of them. And some, you know, they relate more directly or less directly to the integrated resource plan that we're currently engaging with. I will say that, you know, certainly one of the primary benefits of renewable energy, in addition to the fact that we, you know, once it's built, the price doesn't change. We know we have a lot of cost stability there. There, one of the other primary benefits is emissions reductions, greenhouse gas emissions reductions, and the other emissions that are not greenhouse gas accelerants, but or you know, like NOx and SOx and things like that that can have impacts on public health and other environmental impacts. So REAP's, you know, in our long-term vision is certainly a rail belt system that is as renewable as possible and as efficient as possible. Right now, where technology stands and what is sort of commercially and financially feasible, it for the time period that this integrated resource plan covers, which is 20 years, it is unlikely that we will be able to move to that we would be able to move to 100% renewable. But we want to make forward momentum, right? We want to do things because there are things that we can do.
Wow.
Oh, a little static. And maybe just to sort of end that point, I will say that, you know, in addition to over-planning things, I think one thing that folks, I've lived in Alaska my entire life, one of the things that we sometimes tire of is failing to do anything because we're waiting for the silver bullet to arrive. There are a lot of really promising potential technologies, including the sort of next generation of geothermal development and, you know, small modular reactors and things like that that are maybe on the horizon but are not yet commercially viable. That doesn't mean that we can't do things now. Mm-hmm. And we should be doing things now to be iteratively moving toward a cleaner and more cost-stable grid for the rail belt.
Ed?
Yeah, and I'll comment on a couple of those points. One, simplify the utilities. I heard that, and I assume that is a reference to how the system is operated and how it's dispatched. You know, right now, you have three different entities that dispatch part of the system. So the Integrated Resource Plan does look at this from a regional perspective. It does look at this without consideration of who owns which resource. It looks at how is the most efficient way to operate the system, even the existing system. And you also have other legislation that's been passed that is designed to enable that type of system to happen. So I think legislation and the utilities are all driving towards that goal to operate the system, even as we have it just now, more efficiently and identify that. As far as the goal, that's what we're trying to balance, right? We're trying to balance all the things associated with emissions, stability of cost, current cost, cost to construct presently, and also looking at future assets, what their level of maturity is, and designing a 20-year plan that takes into account all those things, recognizing that we'll have to make decisions even as we go forward 5-10 years down the road, looking at these technologies, well, not wanting to prohibit ourselves from making best long-term decisions. And this about this plan, it's not a stagnant plan. It's going to be revisited every 2 years, redone every 4 years. So we'll continue to upgrade this plan so that based upon the technologies that exist, we'll be able to continually make the best decisions going forward.
All right, let's go back to the phones for a moment. Alan is in Anchorage. Hello.
Hi. And this may be naive on my part, but it seems like the state should invest in rooftop solar, either by giving extremely low interest loans or grants or something. It seems like we could ramp up a lot of roofs pretty quickly for the short term, which would be the long term as well. That's just my point. I don't know if it's been brought up, but I'd like to hear comments on that.
Well, and Alan, I would encourage you to connect with the folks here. We did have a caller wanting to know how communities can give feedback. We'll link to the websites that can connect you to places where the meetings will be held and how you can add comments, because this is exactly the kind of thing that I'm sure the folks on the Reliability Council will want to hear from consumers out there. Any thoughts quickly before we take another break about rooftop solar? I know that there's been a cooling effect as far as subsidizing those things on the federal side, but...
Well, yeah, and I will just say, you know, the investment tax credits for rooftop solar expired on December 31st, and that certainly has a cooling impact. And, we have two utility or former utility engineers in the room, so they're sort of how they will talk about integrating distributed renewable generation can get pretty wonky. It is not the simplest thing, but it is certainly doable. And there's a lot more space to do it on the rail belt. It's interesting just to go up to, when you go to Fairbanks in the summer, drive around Fairbanks in the summer, you see a ton of rooftop solar. And part of the reason that is because of the incentives and also just because the cost of power is higher. I would encourage folks to watch the annual net metering bill, which is going to be considered by the legislature this session, and that would change the way in which utilities paid for power that was produced by solar panels on folks' roofs. And in some ways, kind of make the return on investment about equal to what it was when the tax incentives were in place. It's a good bill for consumers and a good bill for the small businesses in Alaska that have developed, the solar installation companies that have developed, that are trying to figure out kind of what's next.
All right. We are going to take another short break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion about the future of rail belt energy as Talk of Alaska continues. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're discussing the future of rail belt energy with the president and CEO of the Rail Belt Reliability Council and two board members of that council, Katie Lister, the executive director of REAP, Renewable Energy Alaska Project, and Travis Million, the president and CEO of GVEA, Golden Valley Electric Association. We have some callers on the line, but I wanted to ask about, the council was created by Senate Bill 123. One lawmaker said there was some other legislation that came along to do some other things. One lawmaker said the system was like four extension cords plugged into each other. The utilities were not united behind this effort. How was it able to advance, and are the utility leaders more supportive now, or is there still reluctance among the players?
I'll start with that one.
All right.
If you don't mind. No, I think there is support from the utilities, even when Senate Bill 123, which founded the legislation that formed the Railroad Reliability Council, there was utility support for that. Is there ongoing friction? Sure, because we're looking at what is best for the whole rail belt system. And maybe there's a specific project that would be better for a specific utility, but it doesn't fit into a whole regional plan sure. as to what would be best for the whole rail belt. So there's going to be friction between what's an individual utility sees as the best project versus what the rail belt sees as the best project from time to time. But in general, you have movement towards regional approaches, not only legislatively driven, but a lot of these bills are been drafted with significant utility input to make sure they can do them, but also because there is a level of support for regional approaches to the rail belt.
I want to combine one of my questions with one that we had by email here. Bruce in Anchorage writes, I would have thought any additional power would be a good thing. What would be an example of a non-beneficial project? Are they all eventually paid for by the public? And then my question kind of combined with that is, one of the concerns was excess power, which I didn't understand. Don't we need capacity or some surplus, especially with Cook Inlet gas supplies dwindling? How do those things square?
So excess capacity. So for years, Matanuska Electric and Homer Electric bought power from Chugach Electric. And there was a large power plant at Beluga that produced significant percentage of the power. And as it aged, the technology was no longer the same as good as what other technology was. And maintenance was becoming a higher cost. It was a remote facility. And it came to the point where it was cheaper to build more efficient generation that reduced gas usage to produce the megawatts of power and to reduce overall costs. And so you ended up with other power plants being built that reduce gas costs, reduce gas usage, reduce losses on the system, and had all these other benefits. Did that plant go away? No, it didn't go away. It's, you know, like your second car. You know, eventually you got to replace that and buy a new one, but it doesn't mean you have to sell the old one. Maybe you want to keep it just for reliability purposes so you have a second car. So there is some excess capacity. I guess you can call it excess, but it's capacity that's just not very efficient. It doesn't run very much, but it provides backup, and it sits right on top of the Beluga gas fields, and that provides some reliability of benefits as well. So excess capacity, but it's not operating, and it provides benefit because it provides reserves if something else breaks down. It has the backup capability to meet the needs. But every time you build something, there's a cost to that. So if I build a new gas power plant that's 1% more efficient than the existing gas power plant, but the interest and the expense right. to maintain that plant is way higher than that 1%, then all I'm doing is bringing costs to members through that additional capital construction. Even though it's more efficient, it doesn't justify the costs.
So that's kind of getting at Bruce's question about, is there non-beneficial projects? That would be an example of one that really wouldn't help us that much. A tiny bit of increase in efficiency, but an enormous expense to stand up an entire new system.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the phones for a moment. Ethel is in Soldotna. Hello.
Good morning. How are you?
Good.
I first of all, thank you so much for this program. My question comes from like two perspectives. One, I was a borough attorney in the North Slope Borough, and in our area, the borough was like the main utility source for a number of outlying villages, while Barrow itself or Calvic had its own utility company. So we had to navigate the capital improvement programs somehow, and that the bond sales process doesn't necessarily translate well to independent utilities all along the rail belt. And the more I listen to this show, it seems to me that the cost of capital improvements or capital, the infrastructure costs would be expanding or reducing depending upon the growth or availability of alternative energy resources. And whatever aging plants needed to be replaced. So I'm assuming that the long-term plan somehow accommodates all of the shifting costs that will be occurring in the next, especially the next decade.
Yeah, thank you for that. This is Ed. Yes, certainly. Part of the things that gets tracked is when plants will be retired, when those facilities will no longer be used and useful, and how are we going to replace those? And the other factor is what's happening to load as load grows, how do you meet that new demand? So certainly, as you look at moving forward with a plan, you take into account what infrastructure is going away, what infrastructure needs to replace that, and what new load is coming on and what infrastructure is needed to serve that load. So, and that has to do with not only what that load is and what those resources are, but where they are and how does that affect your transmission system to move it? And how does load shape change if we're able to implement projects that reduce load in certain communities because of
changing
rooftop solar
or
efficiency improvements or other things. So,
all right, we're almost out of time. I want to try to quickly get one more question in by phone. Laura is in Talkeetna. Laura, please get to your question quickly.
Hey, I just want people to realize that there's a big difference between hydropower, large-scale 850-foot high concrete dams like the proposed Sitna-Wantana and other hydropower that exists in Alaska. And I recently received a survey from basically MEA that was asking me if I would support hydropower, but it did not define it. And I'm not an expert in this, but I know I don't want a large-scale dam in Alaska. I want the Susitna to remain a free-flowing river. So more of a comment, but also a question if somebody wants to define hydropower.
All right. Thank you, Laura.
Katie. I mean, it's a...
And if you're fine, I would jump in on that one a little bit.
Please, sure. Go ahead, Travis.
And the last utility I worked with, we had two hydro projects that we owned and operated. And so completely agree with the caller on that there is definitely a difference between a mega hydro project with a 850-foot tall dam versus others that are in the state. For example, a Runner River hydro project basically will divert the water from a creek, use it to produce electricity, and in most cases, especially the one that the Allison Creek project down in Valdez, puts the water back in the creek before the reach of any of the salmon or the other fish that are there. So from a fish perspective and environmental perspective, it's very, very low impact. The Solomon Gulch project down in Valdez as well is a high mountain lake that is dammed up, and there's no fish impacts up there. In fact, that project is very beneficial from fish standpoint because there's a hatchery that utilizes the fresh water that comes from the lake through the hydro project to rear and grow the fish from that hatchery. But I agree 100% that larger dam projects can have a much bigger economical or environmental and fish impact than some of the smaller ones throughout the state. So, yeah. Definitely got to be mindful of that as we're looking at different projects throughout.
Staying with you for just a minute, Travis, in our final minute here, you have a recent study on how demand will change going forward. Tell us about the load forecast and what the next 5 to 10 years could bring for power demands. And I realize I'm asking a lot in a short amount of time giving you for an answer.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're kind of in a unique spot right now with the price of rare earth materials, military demand within the state of Alaska and the need for building up the military infrastructure in the state, we are seeing that there is a potential for some significant load growth in the interior of Alaska and Golden Valley Service Territory. So where we have seen relatively flat load growth throughout our system for the last decade and a half, we're now shifting gears and having to prepare for some load growth that we didn't see, say, 5-10 years ago. It wasn't on the horizon whatsoever. Mm-hmm. But with the changes that we're seeing, we're trying to prepare for that right now on how we're going to meet those demands. So additional generation is definitely in the mix.
All right. Thank you for that, succinctly getting to that. We didn't get to a caller who was asking, how can communities give feedback on the projects? Where should they go? And we'll link to these places.
I would start by checking out the webinar that is now posted on the Rail Belt Reliability Council website, signing up for the Rail Belt Reliability Council's newsletter, signing up for REAP's newsletter. There is a calendar of working groups. You can join them. If you can't make it because you're just not available at that time, you can watch the recording and submit comments over email. So definitely starting at the websites,
yes,
and with the newsletters.
And we'll link to that at on the Talk of Alaska post on alaskapublic.org. Thanks to my guests, Ed Jenkins, Katie Lister, and Travis Million. Thanks to our engineer, Crystal Hyde, our producer, Madeline Rose. Our editor is Annie Feit, and on the phones, Ava White helped us out today. Thanks to you for listening. We'll be back next week.
Talk of Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.